I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Prime Minister Tony Blair returned to Britain today, and if his head wasn't spinning from his trip around the world in under a week, it was certainly rolling around trying to figure out what the world thinks of him. In the U.S., it was all rather pleasant.
The United Kingdom has produced some of the world's most distinguished statesmen, and I'm proud to be standing with one of them today.
But in China, a reporter traveling with him had a different view.
Have you got blood on your hands, Prime Minister? Are you going to resign over this?
The blood referred to in that provocative question is that of David Kelly, a British expert on biological weapons who killed himself last Thursday. He was caught in the middle of the seemingly interminable row between the British government and the BBC, actually some would say the entire British public, about the failure to find weapons of mass destruction, Blair's casus belli for the conflict in Iraq. There are crises and crises in British politics, and they frequently bubble up in July, just before Parliament recesses and everyone goes on vacation, European style, for a month or more. But this crisis is different. It is real and threatens the government of a Prime Minister who at this time a year ago was one of the most popular and respected politicians in the world. Connection listeners, we're talking about Tony Blair this hour. Has the current row over whether the British government did or didn't sex up the dossier on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction changed your view of Tony Blair? How important was Blair's support for the war in forming your thinking about what to do about Iraq? Can the Bush administration continue to pursue its aggressive foreign policy without the support of its most crucial ally? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. And joining us today to talk about Tony Blair's crisis are Lord Tom McNally, who is Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democratic Party in the House of Lords, and Adam Raphael, Britain correspondent for The Economist magazine. And also on the line is Peter Kellner, Chairman and Chief Pollster of the public opinion research company YouGov. And it's unique in that it's an online public opinion company. And if you're at a computer, there's a link to it on our website, theconnection.org. Welcome to all of you. Hello.
Hello there. We're here.
I know you are. Okay, good. Okay. Well, now that we've got the formalities out of the way, Peter Kellner, let me ask you first, what is the latest public opinion research showing about Tony Blair's standing in Britain?
What it's showing is that Tony Blair's rating, whether you ask whether people trust him to tell the truth or whether he's the best prime minister, both down quite sharply, down around 10 points since the war. It wasn't all that high, it has to be said. Tony Blair in recent times has enjoyed nothing like in Britain, nothing like the approval ratings that George Bush has had in the United States. So a not that good rating has now become a pretty poor rating. He's now down to where past British prime ministers have tended to be in mid-term. You know, we're 2 years from the last election, probably 2 years to the next election. Tony Blair, who until recently had outscored prime ministers for the same point in the political cycle, no longer outscores past prime ministers at this point in the political cycle. On the whole, Britons no longer trust him.
Adam Raphael, this week in The Economist, you have an article, or is it signed? Are you signing articles in The Economist?
We don't sign articles. No,
I didn't think you did.
We're anonymous.
But we can out you now as the primary reporter on an article about Blair's political situation. Is your view that this sudden loss of popularity is a crisis?
Well, I've been through probably too long, and I've been around Westminster for too long, and I'm too used to July crises. So yes, I think obviously it's a serious situation for Blair, but it's not the sort of situation which is going to, in my view, cause a great cabinet convulsion, anything of that kind. Obviously, there is a judicial inquiry about to take place, and if the judge proceeded to be extremely rude about named individuals in the government, they would have to go. But I don't expect that. I don't expect that.
Okay.
And I think, in a sense, this is one of those extraordinary episodes which has blown up really outside the normal pattern of British politics. And I believe in 6 months' time, people will think, was it there? Was it really that bad?
We can talk about that in a moment, but let's just go backwards and just lay out the time scheme of what's led to this moment, including the suicide of David Kelly last week, because this row is not just about Tony Blair and whether he over-egged the pudding in terms of trying to get public support for the war. It brings together in almost it seems sometimes like a mortal combat, two pillars of British society, the British government and the BBC, which is semi-independent of the government. It survives on a massive tax on the British people. David Kelly was, Adam Raphael, a biological weapons inspector who worked for Britain's Ministry of Defence. And how did he get caught in the middle?
Well, there has, as you said, been a poisonous row been developing over the past month between the BBC and the government. And basically the trigger for this row was a programme put out by the Today Show, which is one of our morning radio shows.
Listeners, let me just interrupt for a second, Adam. The Today programme is very much like Morning Edition on Radio 4 in the UK, but with an extra added element, which is in a country where public officials very rarely go on the record, the Today programme actually brings in government officials frequently, and it is often the only time they are publicly actually held to account. It is the news agenda-setting news program in Britain. Anyway, Adam, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just needed to give that background to our listeners.
Not at all. This program, anyway, made a series of sensational allegations. Its reporter, Andrew Gilligan, made a series of sensational allegations suggesting that the government included, against the will of the intelligence agencies, in this dossier which they put out in September trying to persuade the public that Britain should back up the war effort. Anyway, the allegations was that the document had been sexed up, as it was said, and that this specific allegation that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction that it could deploy within 45 minutes was included against the wishes of MI6. And the inference was that Downing Street really was trying to pervert public opinion against the wishes of the intelligence agencies. Now, that was pretty devastating stuff, and it produced an absolutely furious denials out of government, and they began to sort of bombard the BBC demanding an apology. They said there wasn't a word of truth in it. Now, no one knew who the source of these allegations were, but finally, an official who very few people knew at the time came forward to the Ministry of Defence and said he believed he might have been the source for this story, and that was Dr. David Kelly. Now, his difficulty was that he was absolutely caught in the middle. I mean, he was a professional civil servant. He shouldn't have been talking to journalists anyway. The conversation was unauthorised. And he was hauled up before the Foreign Affairs Committee to give evidence. And he was clearly in a very, very difficult position. And frankly, anyone who looks at that evidence now realizes he was not telling the full truth. Now, whatever led to his suicide, I think that must be part of it, as he felt extremely unhappy at the position he'd been put in. One further factor in this very odd and rather complicated story is the way his name became public. The government apparently had given him assurances they would do whatever they could to protect his identity. But governments being governments, what they did actually was to lead journalists to his name, and his identity was soon flushed out with the help, may I say, of Ministry of Defence press officers. And it was a result of that naming and shaming, really, that he came out. The BBC was forced eventually, after Dr. Kelly's death, to acknowledge that he was their source. It's a really messy situation, and it's because of the suicide that the whole thing obviously has got very heightened. And we've now got a judicial inquiry, which is very narrow in its terms, by a Northern Ireland judge, Lord Hutton, who is looking at the precise circumstances in which Dr. David Kelly died.
Peter Kellner, I'm going to ask you, in your soundings of the public, this is an incredibly complicated story, and I think that many of the details and nuances of it are of great interest to people who practice journalism like myself, but maybe, you know, in Yorkshire, people don't give much of a damn about any of it. Is this story actually affecting the Prime Minister's status, the government's popularity?
Yes, it is, and I mean, you're right in your starting point, Michael, that this is a story that is politics as drama, except for those directly involved. It doesn't affect any normal voters' everyday life. It doesn't affect their home, their mortgage, their school, their everyday, their crime rate, their public transport, anything like that. So to some extent, they can ignore the detail. But what is happening is, I think, it's cutting across from the external drama to the point where people are changing their minds about the trustworthiness of the Prime Minister and of the government. And to that extent, it is affecting the government standing, which is falling. And I think when trust is probably the biggest asset that any politician in any democracy has. Once they lose it, it's very hard to regain it. And so while people aren't following the detail about the intelligence dossiers and the very, very arcane arguments about who wrote what when and whether something was flammed up, true or untrue, the general sense has come across to most people that the government hasn't quite been telling the truth. It's been pulling a bit of a fast one on whoever people blame for that. There is now the widespread sense that this lot of politicians is just as bad as the last lot of politicians, the Conservatives in the mid-90s, and that is a very, very damaging position for the government to be in.
Peter, I want to bring into the conversation now Lord Tom McNally, who is Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democratic Party in the House of Lords, and who in an earlier life, as plain old Tom McNally, actually worked for British Prime Minister Jim Callaghan in his term of office back in the late 70s. Lord McNally, inside Westminster, in the House of Lords, and talking to your colleagues in the party in the House of Commons, this loss of trust, is it palpable, or had they long since sussed that perhaps Tony Blair was a politician like others rather than a politician unlike any other?
I think that there was already disquiet, both in his own party and wider, that about the Blair style, and particularly the Downing Street press office style. I fully agreed with Adam Raphael's story. The only thing that he left out was the Iago figure in all this, Alistair Campbell, who is the Prime Minister's communications director, and who brought into Downing Street with him a very aggressive form of spin doctoring, which has been extremely successful in rebuttal and in pushing a certain line for the government, but which I think was already getting a little threadbare before this. And of course, the row with the BBC, Adam rather diplomatically said the government and the BBC. This was personal. Mr. Campbell left his office in Whitehall and stormed down to a television studio and asked for access to one of our evening television programmes to launch a tirade against the BBC. And this, again, has hyped
Lord
up
McNally,
the drama of all this.
I'm going to have to interrupt you now because we're coming up to the break. We're going to pick up on this story, and we're going to look at how Alistair Campbell and has an effect in the story. But listeners, we also want to talk about your view of Tony Blair, your view of whether it's possible for President Bush to carry on his aggressive foreign policy if his best foreign buddy is severely wounded. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. And this is Ian Duncan Smith, leader of the Conservative Party, at the last Prime Minister's Question Time, before summer break, July 16th.
Alistair Campbell and the Prime Minister have created a culture of deceit and spin at the heart of government. When will the Prime Minister realise? Until he sacks Campbell, nobody will believe a word he says anymore.
He says that no one can believe us over Iraq. The truth is the Conservative position now, which is to say that they were somehow misled over Iraq. Well, the worst insult I can level at them is this. It's opportunism worthy of the Liberal Democrats.
Tony Blair robustly defending his position and managing to score points against the Liberal Democrats as well, Tom McNally.
Yes.
Are you an opportunist?
I think we've got a consistency that we can stand by on this. But I think more importantly, just to take your closing remarks then, I think it must seem strange to American audiences that articulate and popular a prime minister in your country should be in such trouble. But I think you can also say that the kind of speech that he made to Congress, which obviously went down so very well in the United States, would cause a good deal of disquiet, not least in his own party. There are a lot of people in Britain that are uneasy about the aggressive nature of American foreign policy. And it's got to be said that President Bush does not command the same respect or esteem on this side of the pond that Mr. Blair seems to command on the other. So I think your listeners have got to understand that he is not on the same kind of patriotic ground that the American president seems to, and the pressures on him and his spokesman to justify the reasons which persuaded the House of Commons to back this war are not going to go away, and they're going to give him problems for a long time to come. And then it's combined with which any journalist in Whitehall or Westminster would confirm, many years now of Alistair Campbell operating an extremely belligerent and aggressive form of press handling, which has built up a lot of resentment.
Well, now, when you worked in Downing Street 25 years ago, did you not have people who went out and secretly briefed against enemies of the government of the day?
Adam Raphael will know. The press officer then was a career civil service servant called Sir Tom McCaffrey. And Tom would no more believe in telling a lie on behalf of the government than he would of shooting his own foot off. I mean, the other worry that has come into British life, we had two great traditions or strengths. One was the British Broadcasting Corporation, and the other is a politically neutral civil service. And both of them are under attack by the style and methods of this government. And that's part, again, of this crisis, that Alistair Campbell is a public official. He is not an elected official. He is an appointee of the Prime Minister, but member of the civil service. And the use of public servants for political ends is one of the problems that is now coming home to roost with this government.
And again, a quick shorthand for Connection listeners. Alistair Campbell is a critical figure in Tony Blair's administration, and he's something like Karl Rove, only with bone structure and younger and more aggressive. He used to be a tabloid journalist, but he does a tremendous amount of the political thinking for Tony, not thinking, but political advice for Tony Blair, planning, and is also and has been a press spokesman, something Karl Rove doesn't do. Adam, is it a different situation now? Has it evolved, or is this something that the Blair government has exponentially done, that is to move manipulation of the press to a whole new level that perhaps hadn't been reached before?
Well, I think, you know, that the whole thing has evolved, but on both sides, government has changed, but so has the media changed. I mean, it has got so much more competitive. It's a 24-hour media. It's a totally different ballgame from the one that I was used to when I began off in journalism. And I think, you know, I don't want to be put in the position of a defender of this government, but there are two sides to this story. And it began off with a BBC broadcast which was inaccurate in very significant respects and was extremely damaging to the government. And you couldn't expect this government not to react to that. Now, whether it reacted wisely or sensibly is another matter. But the fact is, it had been severely attacked unfairly, and it needed to put its case. And I think the BBC still has to acknowledge that there were significant aspects of its story that it got wrong.
Okay, for instance, yes, I was going to ask you the for instance. Go ahead.
Well, for instance, the key allegation was that this document had been sexed up against the wishes of the intelligence agencies.
And the phrase sexed up is more or less what was said by the reporter on the air in the Today program.
All three heads of the intelligence agencies have come out to say that this is not so. And every bit of documentary evidence that has been so far been produced, and no one's seen everything, obviously, there is not a shred of evidence, actually, that, in fact, Alistair Campbell or anyone else in Downing Street altered this document. This was a document drawn up by the Joint Intelligence Committee, which basically is the cabinet committee which tries to coordinate the warring fiefdoms of intelligence agencies on this side of the Atlantic, just as there are warring fiefdoms on the other side. And they produced an agreed document. And it is that document which is considered to have been perverted. Well, they all say it has not been perverted, and the 45-minute claim was inserted, admittedly very late in the day, but it was based on an Iraqi intelligence source which they regarded as sufficiently reliable to include, and that was not done at the behest of Campbell or anyone else. Now, the BBC has yet to acknowledge any of this. It just says, we broadcast our source, we think the source was a good one, which it really was, but unfortunately that broadcast went too far. But the BBC made some other mistakes as well.
Adam, I'm going to stop you there because we don't want to get too deep into a catalogue of these errors, and I'd like to bring some callers into the conversation. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Terry is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, I can understand why Bush might have been motivated to exaggerate these intelligence claims. One, at least, was a short-term boost in his popularity. But I'd like your guest to speculate as to why Blair might have done it, since he took a popularity hit. Did he misread the tea leaves, or did he just do it to bond with Bush?
Tom McNally.
I think he'd already made a commitment to President Bush, which he then found himself under ferocious difficulty to deliver. Don't forget that during the course of this, he lost two cabinet ministers, including a former foreign secretary, and the pressure building up inside the parliamentary Labour Party did make it extremely doubtful whether he could have carried it without the strong assertions that were carried. And although Adam made some comments about the BBC, we all know about the Whitehall Village. And there were concerns being expressed by intelligence officers about the way intelligence was being used in political debate and political argument.
So you're saying if he did it, he had no other choice?
I think that he'd already made the commitment to President Bush, and he was in so deep that he had to carry it forward and carry his party with him. And, of course, now we are back to the finding out whether...
When you say he made his commitment, Tom McNally, you mean that if the war was posited last July in a series of leaks to major American papers about Pentagon plans, that the Prime Minister quite probably had committed to supporting it at that time?
I'm not going to go into things that I can't prove, but I do think that by the time we were into the closing stages of the war, it became increasingly important that the clear and present danger of weapons of mass destruction should be given credence. And anybody that saw Tony Blair making his statements to the House of Commons at that time can be under no doubt that was the case he presented to the House of Commons.
Okay.
Because
Claire Short, who was in Tony Blair's cabinet and who resigned after the war because she felt she had been lied to about the weapons of mass destruction, in her resignation speech indicated that she thought that this commitment had been made at least at the commitment to go to war, at least in September, long before the UN process had really begun to unfold. So you wouldn't agree with Claire Shorten?
I don't know. She's been in the cabinet. I've not. But I've certainly no evidence on this. All as I know is what the Prime Minister was telling Parliament when war was imminent.
Okay. Terry, I'm wondering, in making your own mind up about the justness of the war, whether it was worth going to war, did you pay any attention at all to the British Prime Minister's views?
I have to say that I entered this thing with a little more respect for him than I did for the president. I thought the president was more capable of sexing this up than Blair might have been. So it probably had some effect on me, but I believe the war to have been unjust and unwise from the beginning. But I can understand Bush's political motivations. I just never have understood, in the light of the possibility of an exaggeration, which I believe to be a reality, why Blair might have done it.
Well, that's a question, Terry, that a lot of people are asking inside his own cabinet, for that matter.
Yeah.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. Adam, Raphael, in reporting this crisis as it's kept going and going and going, what's your sense of what the politicians in the Labour Party, particularly those far enough up the ladder to be they're close to the cabinet, maybe in the cabinet, think about Blair's decision-making on this?
Well, he's got his cabinet with him. I mean, Tom McNally is quite right. There were resignations from the cabinet, and that was serious. But the members of the cabinet who are there now, I'm sure, are anxious and concerned by developments. I mean, the suicide of this scientist is very serious, because if it is thought, even popularly, that he was driven to his death by a government, that is a recipe for very serious trouble indeed. And so quite a lot hangs on this judicial inquiry. If the judge, for instance, says that the government totally wrongly leaked this name and gave assurances which it didn't fulfill, that would be extremely damaging, and probably the defense secretary would have to resign. But I think beyond that concern, really this is a cabinet that has rallied behind this Prime Minister. The difficulty, of course, is, both for the President and the Prime Minister, is that they keep on saying that weapons of mass destruction will be found, but none have been found. And the longer this goes on, the less likely any will be found. So, in a way, their credibility, both men's credibility, is at stake, and it's understandable that many voters on both sides of the Atlantic feel they have been gulled, deceived, let down.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ben is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Gentlemen, thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. I have both a comment and a question, and my comment is this, that I think this is a wonderful example of how both of our democracies operate really well and how our press operates. I want to say that I have the utmost respect for Tony Blair. I think he is someone that you're very lucky to have, and a great example for Britain. And I believe that whether or not Iraq was attempting to purchase nuclear materials from a country in Africa has maybe 5% importance in the whole equation. I'm thinking that there were plenty of other reasons why this needed to happen, and I think if you talk to most Americans, they would agree with that, and it's a responsibility that both the United States and Britain have. And I'd just like to say that I think the media in both countries is blowing this far out of proportion to what it really represents in terms of importance, and the opposing parties are blowing it out of proportion. And my question is, don't you agree?
And I was going to formulate that question if you didn't get there. Thank you. Stay with us, Ben. Lord McNally,
Well,
do you agree with that? Is it overblown?
No, I don't think it's overblown. And Ben, you started off by saying it was a tribute to our two great democracies. And to a certain extent, I agree, because the job of opposition parties in great democracies is to hold the government to account. And the job of a free press in great democracies is to probe without fear or favour for the truth. And the fact that the politicians in office feel the heat from those twin forks, I think, show a strength of it. Can I just say about Tony Blair, I share your high opinion of him. For the rest of my life, I will be bemused why he should have put at risk a reputation as high as his for a very dubious venture. But that doesn't take away from the fact that he has been a very successful leader of his party and a very worthy leader of his country.
Well, let me say this. If I was somewhat ambiguous, I was speaking from the standpoint of I'm absolutely supportive of what is going on. I think it's somewhat humorous at times. But what I'm saying is I think the press and the opposing parties are using this as an opportunity to blow things out of proportion somewhat. But I'm absolutely supportive of the activity that's going on. I just want to be clear about that.
Ben, I want to thank you for your call. Adam, there is an element of this, I suppose, that does relate to the particular voraciousness of the British press and getting at a story. And frankly, you know, Tony Blair has won two major landslides. He is and has been until now virtually unassailable. And is there an element in all this of the press finally getting to do more than chew at his ankles and maybe rip his trousers off now?
Well, I think there has been an aspect that the press, without a proper opposition, have almost played the part of an opposition up till now. We've had a very, very weak opposition in the Conservative Party, and the Liberal Democrats, for all their undoubted charms and attractiveness, are very much still the third party. So I think the press probably have played a bigger role, at least in the public's mind, in opposing this government and holding it to account, as Tom McNally rightly says. I think one's got to not to exaggerate, though, the problems this government is in even now. Most governments midterm, all governments indeed since post-war, have at this stage in the parliament been 10, 5, 10, 15 points behind in the polls. This government's 2 points ahead. It's frankly, politics are beginning to arguably restore to a more normal pattern in this country. But the idea somehow this government is in terminal crisis, it isn't, but it is obviously facing a very, very serious storm over this affair. And I think rightly, because frankly, if it went into war without sufficient evidence, then that is a very serious matter.
Adam Raphael will be back with you after the break. Lord McNally will be back with you after the break. Connection listeners, coming up, we're going to talk a bit more, I think, about the relationship and importance of Britain's support in the last 2 years for the way the Bush administration pursues foreign policy. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection, and this is British Prime Minister Tony Blair addressing a friendlier audience than the one he usually faces in the House of Commons, the United States Congress, last week.
My nation, that watched you grow, that you fought alongside and now fights alongside you, that takes enormous pride in our alliance and great affection in our common bond, our job is to be there with you. You're not going to be alone. We will be with you in this fight for liberty.
Tony Blair addressing a joint session of Congress last week and getting the kind of applause that he's not getting at home at the moment. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Michael is calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi, Michael.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
I guess I would just like to say that I've always admired the way that the British system works in terms of the Prime Minister having to defend himself to his opposition in the British Parliament. And I was wondering how the British citizens and the public over across the Atlantic responds to the fact that Bush doesn't have to do that, and the fact that the media seems to take a much softer stance with Bush often in terms of not having him address his opponents directly and having him, in fact, be able to manipulate the press in some ways with his press secretaries.
Okay. All right, Michael, let me put that question first to Lord McNally, Tom McNally. This cultural difference about having greater face-to-face accountability, Tony Blair.
There is undoubtedly a cultural difference. I know the number of Americans who comment about finding Prime Minister's question time compulsive listening and viewing. I think, though, it is different. I've been through American presidents who've had enormous respect on this side of the Atlantic, and others that have had less so. But what I have not had before is this deep unease about the ideological thrust of the administration. And I do think that there has got to be some work on both sides to realise that there is a grave difference of perception from what is coming out of President Bush and his senior advisers about this kind of world crusade that they seem to be on. There is a difference in perception of how the Middle East should be handled. I think there's a difference of perception about the role of the UN in world affairs. The jibe about old Europe was one that actually became a badge of honour in terms of a different view. So I don't think it's just that President Bush gets away with it. I think that there is, in Europe, a different analysis of how some of these crises and problems should be dealt with. Now, it may not be all one way. I think perhaps the Europe underestimates the problems of weapons of mass destruction, their availability to terror groups and the rest, and are being too easy about this. But on the other hand, I do think that the Americans can't be the lone rangers of the world with the UK acting as Tonto. I mean, it just is not possible. And a prime minister that tries to carry forward that role will quickly lose his domestic support.
Adam, just to get a little bit back closer to what the caller was going to say, because that no, that's an important point that Tom McNally makes, but it has to do, I think, with a difference in accountability. Do you've reported from the U.S. I mean, do you feel that Washington Press Corps just operates in a more friendly and collegial manner than the Westminster Press Corps?
No, I don't think so necessarily. And I think you have to recognize that the congressional committees are a great deal more powerful than anything we have in our select committees in Parliament. But I mean, the whole constitutional arrangements are so very different. So it's sometimes easier to think of the president all powerful and the prime minister not. Actually, the prime minister is extremely powerful in this country. He can fire and dismiss his cabinet at will. He can ram through legislation through the House of Commons with a large majority. These are things that the president cannot do. So the idea somehow one is accountable and one is not, I just do not believe it. Actually, I suspect one of the problems of the American presidency is that they have to be watching the polls all the time like hawks. The British Prime Minister actually, most of the time, for 3 or 4 years in between elections, doesn't have to watch them nearly as closely.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Habu is calling from Madison, Wisconsin.
Good morning to you, and good afternoon to the people across the pond. Just two very quick points. I am defending the BBC because I think it's been unfairly lambasted. Priority of a free press in a democracy is to probe, inquire, and ask questions about public policy, and even more so, something as grave as going to war. And I don't think, even though they were at pains to defend or not to expose Britain while it was engaged in war, they still chose to look at these in greater detail, which is so diametrically opposite to the press in the United States, which I think has become a kind of a cheering section for for looking with a jaundiced eye at some of these policies, which are very, which are very profound.
Habu, you have a second point as well.
Yeah, the second point is, as good as Tony Blair is, and I believe he's good, but I think there is a perception elsewhere in the world, and if I can put it this crudely, that he's become a pimp for President Bush and you know, American foreign policy.
Okay. In Britain, they say he's George Bush's poodle. You found a different word starting with P. This is America. So the pimping poodle of George Bush. I can see that creeping into the Daily Mirror very quickly. you get the sense that in other parts of the world, he's seen as being a pimp for the United States. Adam, when you talk to colleagues from The Economist, read reports from other parts of the world, do you get that sense?
Well, I think it's been damaging to Blair that he has been seen to be following too closely to the president. There was a really big call and a big position he had to take last year. Did he ally himself solidly with America or not? And, you know, frankly, all British prime ministers, again, post-war, have always done the same as Blair did. They've always allied themselves. They've always seen their interests as being four square with America. And I think, you know, on that particular policy, it's hard to fault Blair. And once you made that big decision, then you have to bat, as he has batted, solidly behind it all along. I'd like just to respond to the point about the BBC. Of course, you know, one values the BBC. It's a great institution. It's a great broadcaster. But the important thing about journalists, we all make mistakes. We all get it wrong. It's the nature of the trade. When you do get it wrong, the useful thing to do is to hold your hands up. And when you get it partly wrong, you want to say, well, we broadly got it right, but we got this bit wrong. The trouble about the BBC in this episode, it won't admit to any error at all. It should start admitting to error, and its position as a great broadcaster will be even more strengthened.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Simon is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, the gentleman that just spoke actually made the point that I was going to make.
Yeah.
I'm an Englishman that's lived here for 11 years in the States, and I think that Britain gained most of its world power through being a poodle of the United States. And I think that Mr. Blair did make his decision probably a very, very long time before the real decision was made to go to war, because he, like all British prime ministers, gained so much kudos and so much power in the world by being a side issue to the United States that it's very difficult for him to not to agree to do something like that. And the obvious quid pro quo is always the Falklands and that type of,
the quid
pro, when it comes on the other side.
Meaning that the United States tries to work against British interests if the British government chooses to retake by force of arms the Falklands Islands from the Argentine government. The U.S. doesn't endorse that policy thoroughly. Is that what you mean?
I mean that Britain gains through the relationship, and that the classic special relationship is a much more important thing over on the British side of the Atlantic, and that British prime ministers, I think at their peril, jeopardize the relationship between the United States and Britain. And if Mr. Bush wants Mr. Blair to back him on something as large as this, it's difficult for Mr. Blair to say no.
Okay. Simon, I want to thank you for bringing that point up. And I'm going to go on a little bit and say, what does Tony Blair get out of it? And I'm going to give a specific question to both Lord McNally and Adam Raphael.
Shall I go first?
No, because
no?
The specific is this. It has to do with Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah.
Now, there have been any number of prisoners held there, alleged to be part of the Al-Qaeda network, without any hope of trial. And recently, the Bush administration decided that six would be put on trial to move that process along. Two of them are Brits. Now, this has greatly exercised British public opinion, because they won't have access to British lawyers. That, you know, the whole notion of, in fact, The Economist has it on its cover. Was it last week, Adam, that story?
Yeah.
You know, that the U.S. would be judge, jury, defense, and prosecution. And it just doesn't seem right. Will Tony Blair be able to use his influence to at least get those two British prisoners transferred to a British legal system, which is, I think, what the desire of the Foreign Office is? Tom McNally.
Well, first of all, there has been some movement by the United States in that they've now assured our Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, that these two men will not be subject to the death penalty. But I tend to agree with you that this is a test of this special relationship, because one of the worrying things about the war against terrorism is that among the casualties of this war have been civil liberties, which have been cherished on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think that there is a great deal of unease about the cavalier way that this administration has treated civil liberties in the United States and in dealing with these detainees in Guantanamo Bay. And this is a matter that is going to, again, not with the vast public at large, but among people seriously concerned in the way that government operates and the legitimacy of activities of government are very concerned.
So your view, Tom McNally, is that Britain doesn't get as much out of this special, and with Tony Blair, extremely special relationship with Washington, that Washington can ask for support on difficult issues and get it, but on when Britain asks for support on difficult issues, it doesn't necessarily go the other way.
It may not, but let's also get into perspective that there is a massive national interest for Britain in having good and close relations with the United States. And I think all parties understand that. But that shouldn't be on the basis of an unquestioning allegiance, but the basis of the trust of candid friends with the ability to tell each other when we think we're going wrong.
Tom McNally, thanks. I'm going to just throw a quick question to Adam, and we really are coming to the end, Adam. Your view is that this is a crisis that won't bring down a government, but it must weaken Tony Blair. And just quickly, do you think that a weakened Tony Blair actually will make it more difficult for George Bush to prosecute his macho foreign policy in the way he's been doing the last 2 years?
I'm sure Blair will be urging restraint on the president. And of course, some of the actions that have come out of Washington and some of the statements have undoubtedly embarrassed the British government. So there will be a restraining influence there. Whether the president listens to it, one doesn't really know. But I have a feeling that actually Britain's voice is heard in Washington, sometimes disregarded, but it is also listened to.
Thank you, Adam Raphael, Britain correspondent for The Economist. Thanks also to Lord McNally, Tom McNally, Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats in the House of Lords. We heard earlier in the program from Peter Kellner, Chairman of the British Public Opinion Polling Company, YouGov. Connection listeners, to continue this conversation online, visit the forum section of our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our intern is Kate Zarnowski and Alex Begin. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.